Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours.
You don't want to give somebody that power. They don't want that power. You're just releasing power to the outside world, thinking about worrying so much about how they think about you that you're not able to kind of, you know, function or grow as a person. Now, that was me. I don't know if anybody can identify with that or not, but.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. This is your host, me. That was Phil Singleton, CEO, founder of Kansas City Website Designers, as well as author of SEO for Growth. It's an Amazon bestseller. Phil and I have an amazing conversation. We talk about, you know, a lot of parenting stuff, and you'll get the full parenting conversation on the extended version of our interview on our website. Talk about his dad is in the military. We talk about SEO. We talk about analytics, blah, 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 blah. But overall, we just have a fantastic conversation. So I really love chatting with Phil. I love the fact he lived in Asia. So we had a lot in common. So I just spent 2 days at a full-blown strategy session for my school, and my brain is absolutely fried, but it was a fun growth experience. So I was pretty happy about that. Also, please subscribe for my vlog. Now I've got a vlog. Check my blog. Subscribe to my website so you can get the ongoing updates of what's going on. Book is being typeset. So, all right. Everyone, have a nice weekend. I need to jet home. Thank you. Take care. And see you. Don't forget to subscribe and like. All right. On today's episode of Executives After Hours, I had the pleasure, the pleasure to speak with Phil Singleton. Phil, how are you, man?
I'm great. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
No problem. So what I always like to let people do is, and since you're a podcast veteran from interviewing, just give me the quick 10,000 foot view of where you're at and what you do.
Well, if we get right now, I'm based. Basically a web designer by trade. That's kind of how I guess I would define myself technically, but really, you know, we're in the business of creating marketing platforms for our clients. So I'm heavily interested in really my passion, I guess you'd say, is in search engine optimization. And that's because, you know, everybody Googles everything now these days. So if you can help people show up when they're looking for a product, service, or an answer to a problem, I mean, that's the place to be. So,
and what's the name
Google
of the
friendly
company?
Websites. That's what we do. Sorry?
You didn't say the name of your company.
Kansas City Web Design. Can you imagine that? A keyword. My company name is an actual keyword. So yeah. Imagine that. An SEO guy that used a keyword for his company name.
So I was doing a little bit of research on you before we talked, and I saw a couple different things. One, you went to Fairfield University. And two, you went to Thunderbird International School, which is super rad. Are you from the East Coast originally?
No, I actually, my father was in the military really early on. He was in Vietnam. So we kind of moved around in the U.S. while he was abroad. And then he actually worked for a movie theater chain, and we moved around a lot. So what ended up happening is I basically grew up in Florida, where my formative years were, at least in middle school and high school. And then I went off to school in the Northeast after that, and then got a job, at a school, and then the exciting world of insurance.
That makes me want to give myself paper cuts right now. So wait, let me back up, because my wife, was a military brat as well. So I'm always curious, and I've talked to quite a few people who've been military, but I always like to kind of get the perspective from the child side of it. What was one of the biggest impacts of moving around for you, do you think?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because so I was born in Yuma, Arizona, where there's a Marine base there. And then that's where I was born. My sister was born in Laguna Beach, California. Again, there was another base. But since he was in the Vietnam War, I mean, he was out, you know, deployed most of the time during that 8 year period. So, but in that really early years of my life, we were in California and in Arizona. They had at one point, my mom and dad moved back to Kansas City before we moved to Florida again after that. So I didn't really have like the traditional, like growing through up and like really going around like some people do in their formative years as a military brat. Mm-hmm. Mine were pretty much over with, so to speak, because after the war ended, he was out after 8 years. He wasn't like a life or anything like that. He went into the corporate world. So it didn't affect me as much, I think, as most people. But I will say, having a military father, I think, is probably something that's shared no matter what, if you're a traditional military brat or not. And so it was, you know, fairly strict, regimented household, and everything you would expect from somebody that spent a lot of time in the military.
So did your dad? So my dad was also military and went to Vietnam as well. And I think he may have only been in 4 years. I think he got in and out pretty quick. Let me describe a situation that I had in my house all the time, and let me just see if your situation was the same. So you get in trouble, and every response was yes or no, sir.
Yes, yeah. That's pretty much.
Yeah. So I love telling this story because this was like my moment of rebellion. I was the youngest, and my dad was a saint in that he married my mom, and she had two boys that were 5 and 3 at the time. And so I was 13 and I got in trouble for something. I don't know what the hell I did, but I was in his bedroom. He was lying on the bed watching TV, and he lectured me, and he's like, all right. I was like, okay. He's like, yes. And so I said, yes. He's like, yes, what? I shrugged my shoulders. Yes. He's like, do you understand me? And I'm like, yes. Yes, what? This went on for like 5 minutes, and I wasn't going to give in. I was like, nope, nope. Now,
so you knew, all right, you were playing.
So I was playing the total game. Now, again, I can't speak for your dad, but my dad, he was raised in a house where if you disrespect, usually you got smacked. Like that was just kind of it. Not beat, smacked. I think there's a difference, you know, just to be clear. And so I kept waiting for him to get out of bed and just smack me because I wouldn't say sir. And after 5 minutes, he just said, you could just see him get pissed. And he was just like, just get out of my room. And I was like, sweet. And for me, that was like the highlight of my teenage years is that I defeated my
victory.
Dad in the game of sir. So like,
yeah.
Did you ever?
You know, ours was pretty, I mean, it's really interesting. It's like, I didn't, so I got a little bit of difference because mine was, my father was in the military when I was early on and left. But then one of the things that happened to me is it's kind of an interesting story. It's got a happy ending, but you know, my parents got divorced when I was, I think, 7 or 8, maybe 6 or 7. And then after like 6 or 7 years, they got back together again.
Huh.
So it's one of those cool, happy endings. So then I ended up getting a kid brother out of the deal, which was even really cooler. So I got a brother of mine that's 14 years younger than me. So I had that kind of, you know, early experience, father kind of moving around. He was out. Then he kind of was gone. Divorce came back. But I will say one thing that's kind of interesting when I was growing up is, you know, when we only saw my dad, like in those years that they were divorced, every once in a while, because he actually was in California or in Kansas City. So it's really interesting when you see a parent that's actually kind of maybe a little bit on the strict side occasionally, because they're kind of like the helicopter and, you know, there's presence and we haven't seen in a long time. But then after, you know, I had come in and had been absent for, you know, a while, at least on a daily basis. Really, that's where it was kind of a rude awakening of you got the military guy discipline coming in when you've had a run of it for, you know, 12 years or so. And now there's like somebody coming and putting these kind of strict rules on. So that's really for me where there's a big, I guess, change because I didn't have it the full time. So I kind of had a father, not to say fatherless, but you know what I mean? I had, maybe it's my mom's show and there wasn't that daily kind of discipline, I think, that was coming in. So that was kind of a rude awakening.
How'd that go when your dad shows up again and you're 12, 13? You know?
It was great. I mean, it's great to come back, but again, the honeymoon period's over, and then there was just more rules and more things that, you know, it really, looking back, it's like you can see how obviously, I mean, there's people that are raised in households with only one single parent, but you know, having the father in there and adding some, you know, discipline that having somebody look up to might have made, you know, now I'm on a path where I've, you know, have a lot of things where I can look back and have been inspirational. Whereas if I didn't have that in those formative years, I might've gone a different direction. You know, that's kind of how I look at it is,
so you took the positives out of it really.
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, it was tough. It was really hard to come in where you kind of, you know, you get used to, you know,
it's almost having like a bet or something.
Sorry?
Were there some heated fights
A little bit. I think when, like, as teenage years, when I kind of wanted to stand my, you know, ground a little bit. But most teenage fights were between me and my sister, not between me and my dad.
So then, was, like, your home, like, essentially was Florida. What part of Florida?
Tampa, Clearwater.
Okay, okay. So, all right, what was it like for you? You know, we kind of talked about this a second ago, but you said that when your dad came back in the picture. So what you said, your dad was in the movie theater business, and you guys moved around early on. So early when I asked you the question about what was one of the outcomes of having a military family, maybe the question I should have asked is, did you see a difference? Are you able to reflect on the fact that you moved a lot early in life and how that impacted your relationships and stuff?
Well, I think it made me a little more adaptable and not feel, because you see some people that you grew up, especially here, I'm in Kansas City right now, that have probably never or left or never moved away and wouldn't consider it. So by being almost forced to go out and, you know, make new friends and things like that, I think actually feels kind of painful when you're younger, but really helps you, I think, when you're older in terms of not being scared to take other risks, which I think is something we'll get to later. I mean, I literally, after 3 years after college in the insurance industry, after a 2 week, I think, period, I just packed up my bag and moved to Asia, which I probably would have never done if I didn't have the experience moving around and adapting a couple times. And taking that kind of adventure when I think people at that time really thought I lost my mind.
So it's one more question about this because I have a hypothesis that I'm fairly proven correct just because my wife moved a ton as well. And many other people I've talked to have moved a ton. Same thing. So I'm going to describe to you a scenario. I'm going to put you in the scenario and you tell me if this is true or not. So you get into a new room, let's say you move or whatever, and you're able to make friends or connect pretty quickly. Right now, you've been in Kansas City for how long now? 10 years? 15?
Yes. Okay. Since we've moved back, sure.
Okay. So, the place that you lived before was where? Was it in Arizona?
Before Kansas City was Taiwan.
Okay. Oh, geez. All right. So,
that was 10 year stint, and all together was in Asia. So,
holy crap. Okay. We'll get to that in a second. So, what I'm curious about, what I'm trying to get to is that typically what I find is that people who moved around a lot as a child are really great at making friends, really shit at keeping friends after they move.
Probably. Yeah. I mean, honestly, I don't even have that. I don't, you know, a lot of people keep up with their college, but of course Facebook came in a little bit. I was,
Cause how old are you?
I'm 47.
Okay. Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Yeah. I don't really keep in super great contact even with my college buddies, which is kind of, I guess, embarrassing, but it seems like you're right. I mean, that does, that has me kind of have a little bead of sweat on my forehead. You probably just kind of saw right through me a little bit, but yeah, I think that's true. You go in and you can adapt and do what you need to do to kind of make new friends. And then you don't really keep them as you move along.
Yeah. Maybe my wife.
A lot of truth there.
Yeah. My wife is amazing at it. I mean, she is like, we lived in Philadelphia for 7 years. And we hung out with this family all the time. And her friend, obviously, was the mom of the kids. And the kids were roughly my kids' age. Hung out all the time. They worked out together. Literally, she's talked to her 3 times since we moved here about a year and a half ago. And I was like, how do you do that? Like, how do you literally never? Now, I say that. I don't talk to any of my college friends. I talked to one friend I met when I lived in Asia for a year, not 10. But I talked to one friend, and that's kind of it from my past. So I'm very similar to that. Where I can make friends pretty easy where I'm at, but keeping them is always a different thing. I think as a guy, we're actually doubly handicapped at it, to be honest with you.
Exactly.
You know, but my wife is like,
well, look at it. You get so zeroed in, and if eventually you find something you really love to do, you're thinking about that a lot. And for me, even with sports and stuff, I'm at my twin boys now. We had them late in life that they're 8 years old, and it's just right now it's family and work. I don't even really care about much else. So, I don't know. It really has. Even from that extent. Yeah. I mean,
you know, so I just think it's really interesting, you know, and I think from a family standpoint, you know, because you had twin 8-year-olds, so you had your kids when you were 40, 41.
Well, they're 8 now. So it's like 39, 38. Okay. I think my wife was pregnant. Yeah, it was. Yeah.
What was that like suddenly popping out having 2 kids at one time? It was funny.
Yeah, I was one of these things where it's like, let's wait a little. I mean, every year you go by, I was one of these guys. Yeah. So I was like, oh, it'll be easier. We'll have more money.
Yeah, exactly.
But then as you wait. Well, as you wait, you know, Mother Nature makes you wait longer. So it's one of those deals that, here's the one thing I say, I think that having twins, like literally almost damn near killed me.
Yeah.
Because I was so, you get older. The stakes feel a lot higher. You can't like bounce back as much. I didn't sleep the first 3 days my twins were born because I was so had so much anxiety and concern about it. It was really tough.
And the first year, like, what was the anxiety about it?
I don't know. I guess it wasn't like a lot. I mean, I've been somebody that suffered with anxiety early on for quite a long time. For some reason, that primal anxiety just kind of kicked in. And it just, for me, just all of a sudden my nerves got amped up so high that I couldn't turn them back. And I literally couldn't go to sleep for like, it was just felt, you know, thing. So I don't know what triggered it. It wasn't like, you know, there's certain things you have when you have anxiety or you maybe even prone to a little bit of depression every once in a while. It just triggers. It's a physical thing. It's not like you're like, I'm anxious about this. It's all of a sudden your body just turns into something else
like
for a little bit.
You can't label it. Like, you're not sure what it is, but it's just a feeling.
Right. Yeah. And it just doesn't dial itself back for whatever one. But and it was probably because kids, nerves, stakes feel a lot higher. Like you're a little older in life. So it's like you don't see things as like not being effective. You think everything's kind of a big deal. And so the first year or two, man, I really struggled. We didn't really sleep. My wife and I literally slept in shifts. We did not sleep while the kids were like the first 2 years. So I would go and stay up until like 2 o'clock and then she would wake up and we were so nervous about having, you know, kids because we just didn't have any experience and we had them too late, you know. So but as they got older, when people get more, I mean, we found it to get a lot easier. So now we've got a little laid back. We're not worried about every little fever now, every little scratch and stuff like that. So I can see why having like the second and third kid would be a lot easier. Although you see a lot of people stop at twins, and I know why now, because it's not like having two at once. It's actually like having four at once, because you know, there's no other person. There's always one. You know what I mean? A parent with a newborn has always got one to change hands. When you got two, there's no backup. So
now imagine the parent who has three, who has triplets, right? like man, fuck that, right? Like for me, there's no way I could deal with that. So all right, so let's fast forward a little bit here, because you know you do all these things. Now when you were in Taiwan, did you also then own a website business there as well?
No. So what ended up happening there is I worked the .com era. I ended up, the job I got out of MBA school or out of Thunderbird was with kind of a hybrid, I don't know what you'd call it, like a venture capital / business development firm. So it was really nice during the .com days, that pre-bubble thing, to be able to go out and talk to Asian investors and pitch North American startup, you know, .com companies back when that was kind of the thing. And that's what I did. But what ended up happening really after a nice 3-year run there is that bubble just literally like popped over one night. So all the stock market just completely crashed from a tech standpoint. But after that, I ended up still doing some like business development work for North American companies like in Asia. So that is helping them get business development partnerships and other types of stuff. But what ended up happening is I had this one company that literally kind of ended up falling in my lap. It was a consumer software company. And you may have heard of it, you may not have, but it was called DVDX Copy. And if you remember Napster back in the day, but Napster was one of these companies that helped you, you know, get music online for free type of thing. Well, there was a digital video follow-up to that one related to it, but the video version was called DVDX Copy. So we had this copy that in the early 2000s that enabled you to copy DVD movies. So you'd buy them from, you know, Best Buy or whatever, and then make a backup copy. So that you, you know, your kids played it over and over again, you could use the backup copy and then keep the original. That was the premise of the sale.
I wouldn't call that stealing.
Yeah. Well, that's what ended up happening is they sold, like, it did great for the first few years, and then Hollywood caught on and ended up suing the company in the States. But there was a 3-year legal battle where, while this was happening, they were selling the crap out of it. And it was like a $200 million company by the time, I mean, in sales.
Wow.
I think by the time they shut them down in the States. But what happened is I was in Asia. I happened to be doing business development for the company. Hollywood shut this company down that was based in St. Louis, Missouri. And then they literally said, hey, Phil, we got to set this up, because it was still legal to sell this stuff online and around other retail markets around the country. So I had this moment where, you know, these guys said, we need you to set this company up here. Do you think you can take this over and do it like right now? And, you know, I looked at them with the confidence I'd built and said, yes. Meanwhile, I think I had a little bit of pee running down my leg saying, am I really ready for this? But I did it, and it was a really great experience, because that's what turned me on to Google and figuring out how people actually searched and bought things online. I learned a ton.
What year was this?
We had a really good run on that for a couple of years, ended up selling that company. But, you know, what I really learned was we were selling this company online throughout the rest of the world, everywhere. And we had these affiliate marketers, right, on these other websites where they'd click through and come to our software website and buy it. Well, the big affiliate marketers were getting like 50% of the sale, right? So we had guys that we were writing checks out to that were probably working an hour a week on their forum or their blog or the precursor to blog, whatever they had. And I was just writing checks for like $50,000, $60,000, $80,000 a month for just one graphic ad because they'd click through and we'd track the sales and affiliate, right? And I was like, holy cow, here we've got 25 employees, investors, product support, product development. Our share of that affiliate, you know, our 50% of that sale basically got whittled down to nothing. And here are these other guys who are, you know, controlling getting where the customer is based on this affiliate model. They were getting half the sale and basically almost no work, you know, and we were only one of their affiliates. They probably had lots of guys writing them big checks every month. So that really opened my eyes. I was thinking, why is this happening? How are they getting this traffic? A lot
what
of it even back then track. Sorry.
What year was this?
This was early 2000s, maybe 2000, okay. 2003, maybe.
Okay. And so you sell the company, you realize that, hey, there's a different way to do this. When do you move back to the States?
2005, I think we're into 2005.
Okay.
Sold it. It was a nice payday. It wasn't relaxed, you know, and buy an island type of thing. I'm in my early 30s type of a deal. So moved back to the States and I figured it was nice because we had some money, bought a house, got started. But then I was like, what the heck am I going to do? And what ended up happening was I got driving around Asia on a motor scooter. And we did have a car back then, but it was small. But we got a car and I ended up getting a little sports car, like a 350Z, I think it was. just because I wanted to drive stick shift and, you know, midlife crisis or whatever it was, an early one. But I ended up hooking up with this one auto detailer. And the poor guy was like doing these auto details for $25 a car. And he was just getting killed. He didn't have a good retail operation. I'm like, dude, you should have your own website. You could be selling these details for $100, $200 versus like $25 for almost nothing, killing yourself. So long story short, I ended up making a promise I didn't think I could keep. I told this guy, let me build you a website. Mind you, I learned about it, but I'm a finance guy. I had guys doing the software, making the websites, never built a website in my life. But I did see the vision by having this experience with this DVDX copy company. So
and this is like early day WordPress.
It was Microsoft Front Page.
Okay.
It was like a one page. And again, I figured it out. I made a promise I didn't know I could keep. I told this guy, I'm going to do this for you and we're going to figure out. Like, I think there's a thing. So I did it. We set up a website. He had his first website. This is like 2005. And then lo and behold, 60 days later, he calls me up and he's like, dude, I don't know what you've done. You've changed my business. You've changed my life. I could hear like the tears in his voice type of a thing. And at that moment, that was the one moment in my life where I was like, oh my God, I know what I want to do when I grow up. This guy just called me up and gave me literally, I can remember, you know, it's kind of giving me goosebumps right now as I'm saying it. But, you know, to have that kind of effect on a small business where you actually brought him to tears on the phone was the most rewarding thing business-wise that's really ever happened to me. One, and two, I was like, holy crap, I can make money off this. You know what I mean? And then I was like, okay, that really said it was that one did kind of on a barter one page, literally the ugliest purple and yellow website that was ever created. And that thing rolled into a couple other referrals and barter deals, which has then now rolled into what I consider a thriving digital agency that's opened the doors up to all sorts of things, you know, books and courses. And you know, I've got other agencies that are licensing the model that we have right now. And it all started from one, you know, one promise on a small business website.
So, you know, it's funny because you say like that, it was that call that made you realize you wanted to do that for a living. But it kind of begs the other question. Was it something that it gave purpose to because the response that you got made you feel so valued about what you produced? Does that make sense? Like you have someone call you in tears. You just thought you were helping a guy out. And next thing you know, he calls you up saying, you've changed my life. That has to give you purpose.
Definitely.
You know that has to give you this sense of, man, I could replicate this. I could get that warm, fuzzy feeling again and again because this one guy gave me the juice, so to speak, to say, hey, you've changed me. And so I would imagine for me, that sense of confidence that I would get that I did something great based on the feedback that someone gave me would push me pretty hard in that field, whether I loved SEO or not. I think it would push me hard just because of that almost adrenaline rush that you would get. Does that make sense?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, you boil it down like that. It's exactly, I mean, just really, you know, so you're looking to do stuff where you're not in a job and doing something, you know, trying to make a living where you're not happy,
yeah,
you know, doing it. But then once that, I guess, sense of purpose is so clear, mm-hmm. Where you can be doing something that motivates you to, and also, be, you know, to me, it feels like I'm actually, and I feel like I am, I feel like I'm making a good living, but I think I'm actually contributing to helping other people, you know, grow their business. Yeah. That's a major sense of purpose, that just changes everything for me, really.
So let's, you know, again, you've been pretty good with your time. We've been talking for about 46 minutes. Let's quickly pivot, to talk about then what you're doing and some questions that I'll have, but just for my audience, I know that you co-wrote a book. So what was the name of that book? And I know they can get it on Amazon, but what's the name of the book?
The book is SEO for Growth.
I should have guessed that, by the way.
You knew SEO was going to be in there somewhere.
Yeah. I read that earlier, but okay. So the book is SEO for Growth. It's on Amazon. It's a bestseller. What was the impetus of writing that book with your co-author? What was your co-author's name?
John Jantz. Some people will be familiar with Duct Tape Marketing.
Yes.
A small business marketing kind of a guru out there. As lots of them out there right now. But
yeah.
Yeah, he's been around. He wrote, that's a Wall Street Journal bestseller, his Duct Tape Marketing. He's written, I think, three other ones on top of that. But yeah, he was my co-author, so that was a big score.
And so, all right. So let me dive a little bit into this SEO thing, right? So first of all, how did you gain your competency on the SEO? Did you take courses? Did you just basically explore? Do you keep reading new content? Because I know Google constantly is changing their algorithms, like on an hourly basis almost. So how do you stay up to date of the best practices?
Well, so getting started, you know, when I got into it, it was still, and this is early too. I mean, Google did, I think, 97, and it wasn't really, you know, it was, yeah, a few years before it really became mainstream. So, because I was involved in software, I think I was early on, but there weren't, I mean, we didn't have a lot of courses or anything. So you almost kind of had to, a lot of the people that have been doing it for more than, you know, 10 or 15, maybe 15, 20 years had to have self-study because there just wasn't a lot of, you know, courses or information out there. So I kind of got into it learning little bits at a time and just kind of staying up with it. And that's kind of how we do it right now. But so the big thing's really been, one, we're in this business, so there's lots of different places you can go to, like, stay on top of what's happening. We listen a lot. One of my favorite websites is called Search Engine Roundtable, and that guy does a great job of aggregating the chatter around folks that are in the business, like myself, in terms of seeing what kind of changes are being made this today or this week. And then because Google doesn't, the last thing they're going to do is tell you how their algorithm works, right? So we have to extract it. So by staying on top of the industry this way and listening to the news site and keeping my ear close to the ground, and also having a big book of clients. I mean, look, when I have my own 100 websites or so that I'm doing on behalf of the clients, and I can see what's happening to their sites on a daily basis by the tools that we use to see their traffic rankings and their traffic. So we can kind of know what changes Google's making, what things that we're doing to websites that are making the needle move. So just staying close to the industry, keeping our ear to the ground, listening to other people, and doing this year in and year out really kind of helps you see patterns and stay close to, you know, the updates and things that are happening, so you know what's up. Now, the good news is SEO has changed quite a bit in the last 5 years or so. It used to all be about trying to do, you know, little tricks and tweaks to your website under the hood and with the content, creating pages, or, you know, doing all these volume-based, like, backlink building things where you'd go out and hire people to get links from you from wherever you could, get as many as possible. And that kind of stuff moved the needle. And that's really what drove SEO for, like, the first 15 years while Google was around. Then, of course, they came around 5 years ago and they started to create these more punitive algorithms. So in the past, where it was only 100%, like, almost reward-based, meaning throw everything that you can against the wall and we'll only count what sticks. About 5 years ago, they started looking on the ground and penalizing your website for the stuff that was falling, right? So if you were doing these things that were prohibited and trying to do all these things where you're really trying to blatantly game the system, you actually got a penalty for that. So that really changed behavior in SEO. And where Google for a long time said content was king, about 5 years or so, when this panda and penguin out and all these other animals came out in terms of the algorithmic changes they made, they really meant it. They really meant content is king, and it's really helping. So people, the SEO industry changed its behavior. They brought a lot of it onshore. People start focusing a lot more on the quality of their websites and making the user experience better. They started to invest in things like blogging and blogging on their website, doing podcasts now and things like that, but also focusing on other signals like social media, reputation management, and really looking at your web presence in terms of like this holistic thing. That's the stuff that's really moving the needle and helping people get visibility right now. But the key to it still comes down to your website. Your website has to be the referral source for all your content. You can't create a piece of content and then go put your best piece of content and post it once on Facebook. Does you no good. It does you okay good for a little bit in real time, but what you want to do is be posting that stuff on your website so people have to come back to it so that you can remarket to them and do this kind of thing and make that your body of work. And this kind of, it's really what SEOs really become these days is building up a website, investing in content, making it the referral source for all your best content, so, and then distributing it out and making people come back, you know, to get all the good stuff getting from that piece. And when you do this and you think about your website the way Google thinks about it, it kind of helps you tie everything together and get a better ROI to marketing. But more importantly, it helps you get more Google visibility because that's where people go, you know, for answers and to pick the best products and services. So that's kind of, it's evolved.
That's awesome. Well, listen, Phil, you've been awesome with your time. So I have one final question that every guest must answer before they get off the show. And that is, and by the way, I really appreciate that SEO conversation because it's actually a very complex, it's a complex word that may not be that complex, if that makes sense. And so, you know, I'm sure you've been on, you're on a ton of these. Ah, shit. Can't hear me. Damn. I have one more question. Oops. Question. I can hear.
I can hear you now. Okay. I got you.
All right. So let's just quickly then before it shits out again. So my last question I ask everybody before they get off the show is, and if you can't hear me after I'm done, that's fine. I can hear you. So don't worry about it.
Okay, just keep talking.
Is Phil, how do you define happiness for where you're at and for what you do?
From a professional standpoint or just family or all the way around?
I'm going to let you define it however you want to define it.
I think for me, happiness is being able to have the career that I have right now that enables me to stop whenever I want and be able to enjoy time with my family whenever I'm needed to do that. And that's a huge thing that's improved my quality of life. And I think makes my family and my children happier, which in turn then makes me happier. Because that's for whatever reason, that's what does it for. And then also I talk about this a lot with other people. In fact, I'm just thinking about hiring another person today. And I was just saying that the most important thing to me really is we just have to treat people with the same kind of respect and give them excellent service no matter what. So one thing we should just never like miss on. And if you can do that and make other people and help them relieve their stress and make them happy, then it in turn makes you happier. So the last thing I want to do is create stress for one of our clients because of lack of communication or they weren't happy with something that we delivered and we didn't make an effort to make them happy. Because at the end of the day, if somebody comes in and you can't, you know, solve their problem, then if you can show them the effort or help them work to solve that problem, they end up being happier, which then I think makes, at least for me, it ends up make me being happier. So, you know, giving our best, trying to make sure that we maintain that high level of service with our clients, but also really everybody. I look at everybody in our business as a client, whether they're a contractor or a W-2 employee or anybody else. It's like we're trying to keep people, you know, as happy as possible and treat them. Really, I almost turn it back into like, I call it like the review culture. I look at everybody these days as you know, what would this person say about me online, whether it's online or offline? And I just try and make it so that we're always treating people with respect and give giving them our best effort all the time. And by doing that, I think has enabled me to live a happier professional life. It's been able to help me grow my business, and it's been able to get me the best parent and the best dad and spouse I can be, I think.
That's awesome. Well, Phil Singleton from Kansas City Website Design and SEO, thank you for your time, your energy, and your willingness to sit down with me on Executives After Hours.
Hey, thanks so much, James.
Have an awesome day.